Okay, Marshall, please call the next case.
Now calling A23-1314, Connie Jean Raby et al. Appellants versus Bradley Aubrey Slater, respondent.
Well, welcome again to the Court of Appeals. This is our second case on the calendar today for oral argument. And as you probably both know, you each have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes. Feel free to adjust the podium, and please remember to introduce yourself, identify which client you're representing, and let us know if there's any pronunciations we need. With that, counsel for appellant, there are 15 minutes on the clock, so feel ready. Feel free to begin when you are ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Jason Brown, and I represent the appellants in this case, Oben Coffey and Gessen and Connie Raby. Your Honors, we are asking the court to reverse and remand to the district court in light of the findings of fact and conclusions of law that it outlined in the decree following the trial in this case. Our argument is based principally on an abuse of discretion, although there is also, I believe, some argument concerning the potential for de novo review based upon a misapplication of the law. What we're essentially arguing is that the district court abused its discretion in granting the grandfather in this case sole legal, sole physical custody of the minor child, as well as the predominant amount of time with the minor child. With regard to abuse of discretion and this court's standard of review, I know the court is familiar, but just to reiterate, the findings in this case are unsupported by the evidence. There was an improper application of the law. And using the clearly erroneous standard, which is rather broad, even if there's some evidence to support a finding, it may be clearly erroneous if this court believes there's been a definitive or firm conviction that a mistake has been committed by the district court. And we respectfully submit that that has indeed happened in this case. I presume the court is familiar with the very challenging and traumatic underlying facts involved in this case. It was not an easy case to manage for the lawyers or the clients. But we believe first that there was an abuse of the district court's discretion with regard to the application of the joint physical custody factors that are found in Minnesota Statute 257C, 0.04 subdivision 2. And with regard to that statute, the first thing I'd like to call out is the fact that the respondent in this case has suggested that it was appropriate for the district court to only apply these joint physical custody factors to the parties, in this case, my clients, the grandmother and the father of the child. It was appropriate to only apply those joint physical custody factors, or legal custody factors for that matter, to them. When in fact, the statute is clear that if two or more parties seek custody of a child, the court must consider and evaluate all relevant factors, including, and then the statute goes through those 12 best interest factors, but then says specifically, in addition to those factors, if either joint legal or physical custody is contemplated by someone or sought, the court must consider the following relevant factors. And the factor specifically says the ability of the parties to cooperate with regard to the rearing of the child. The statute doesn't limit the application of cooperation merely to the litigants who are seeking the award of joint physical custody or joint legal custody. I've spent a fair amount of time in
who
family.
Who else would be cooperating except the two grandparents?
There, in this case, Your Honor, the specific facts are that there are actually three litigants. You've got the biological father and the two grandparents.
You know, my wording, not my treasured colleagues, and again, I'm using my wording, it seems like he's out of the picture for the most part. And now, is that a fair statement?
I don't think that's a fair statement, Your Honor.
Why isn't it?
You're asking with regard to the biological father?
Yes, I am, sir.
Yeah. Because there is ample evidence to suggest that both following and prior to the birth of this child, he has and was significantly involved. The testimony reflects that for years leading to this action, he and grandmother worked together to assemble a plan for this minor child. The evidence reflects that at the time that the protective services...
So are you saying the record doesn't reflect the vacillation?
I don't believe that it does reflect vacillation.
Why not?
Because, Your Honors, from our point of view, and I think by definition, vacillation sort of requires, and in my mind, I see it as a bouncing back and forth, one position to another, one position to another.
Is it fair to say his position as to custody changed from one grandparent to another during the course of this litigation?
Absolutely, it changed.
So you're saying it has to go back again. So it changed from one to the other, okay, and you're saying, and I'm not going to get into this, you know, debate of the dictionary's definitions, you're saying it wasn't vacillating because he didn't go back to the other party?
Yes. I would respectfully
what
submit...
What case says that?
I don't know that there's a case. We've cited the dictionary definition, and I know the argument before us relied on the dictionary.
Speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, I've never been a huge fan of battle of the definitions. I mean, the issue for us, and I will just say, you know, when I looked at the district court's order and when I looked at your brief, what I really thought you were attacking at the end of the day was the credibility findings that the district court made listening to the testimony of the parties. And, you know, that's the one thing we can't do. So why am I wrong when I'm saying that's what you're wanting us to do? There seemed to be record support even for 1, 3, and 7 of the factors. The district court carefully listened to everyone, made its conclusions, and now you're asking us to somehow say the record doesn't support those findings when, again, speaking for myself and not my colleagues, I think it does. Why am I wrong?
Two points. Thank you for the question, Your Honor. The first is we have started our brief with an assertion that there was a misapplication of the law proper, that the court did not apply the joint custody factors to grandfather in this case. The scrutiny that was placed by the district court rested solely with my clients.
Can I ask you about that, though? So, I mean, assuming we agree with you that the even though it wasn't grandfather who was moving for joint custody, but that the joint, because he's a party in the language of subdivision 2A1 is ability of the parties, he moved to intervene as an interested third party, right? Assuming that that's right, why can't we read the district court's order to satisfy the must consider the following factors in terms of its broad characterizations of the dynamics between all three of the individuals in this case as satisfying that issue? If that's one of your stronger points, that this is a de novo review of statutory application, why can't we read the district court's order as addressing that concern? Because certainly the district court went to some lengths to describe the challenges that you were talking about between all the parties throughout this case.
The court did, but what the court didn't do specifically, it's not in the order under its analysis. It broke down in its order each of these elements under subdivision 2 of that statute. And with regard to the cooperation factor, the court merely expressed, and I'm quoting now, significant concerns about grandmother and father's ability to cooperate. The court was silent with regard to grandfather. And I know your question was preambled by a statement that the grandfather in this case sought joint physical custody. He didn't. He came to the court.
No, that wasn't my point. I think one of the responses to your argument is that the party seeking joint custody was grandmother and father, right? In the
grandmother and one of the things that I'm asking the court as a response, second response to your question, Judge Connolly, is to just back away and look at this case from 10,000 feet. There have been a lot of change dynamics throughout the course of this litigation. It took 16 months for us to get to the trial in this case. The case started very differently than it ended. The case also took a major pivot point following a mediation session that occurred in early 2022. And that's the key. It seems the district court lost the forest and the trees. What we have here is a path that first starts with a mutually cooperative relationship between grandmother and father regarding the raising of this child. And then we have the concern with the Child Protective Services notification. And that's when grandfather, from my chair, saw an opportunity and began to fill father's head with false ideas. And at that point, persuaded father to do certain things, and at that point said to the court under oath, father, and I'm paraphrasing, father is a good father. There's no reason to remove this child from this father's care. Father should have the right to decide who cares for this minor child. But during the course of that mediation, father began to learn and see what grandfather was doing. He was putting pressure on him. He was giving him false information, which led him to believe that grandmother was something that she truly wasn't. And it was after that revelation that he didn't, with due respect, vacillate. He changed his mind because he understood the circumstance that he found himself in. And when he changed his mind, to the shock of many, grandfather took a different tack. And all of a sudden, grandfather's narrative changed.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Just because your time's winding down. So we have case law that says a district court must make detailed findings for each of the best interest factors. Is there a case that says the district court needs to make a detailed finding as to the joint custody factors? Because the statute just says must consider. So it would seem to me for you to prevail on your argument, assuming we agree that the district court erred by not including grandfather in its calculus, there would have to be something indicating that the district court didn't affirmatively consider. Because I'm not aware of something that requires the district court, although obviously best practice would make it better for review to have it specifically as to every party, if we agree with your argument, stated. But I'm not aware of a case that says that it's error for the district court not to make detailed findings on the joint custody factors. Am I wrong about that?
Well, 2 points. First, the statute itself says the court must consider them. I know it doesn't say the court must issue findings that reflect, you know, its analysis, but the court must consider them. But second, in this case, the court did make specific findings, and they analyzed all four factors within its order. And it's those findings that we take issue with. The record does not support significant concerns the district court had about my client's ability to cooperate. In fact, there was only a single incident of potential non-cooperation involving what happened with CPS 3 years ago.
But doesn't that go back to the point that Judge Connolly made about the discretion that the abuse of discretion standard, and the fact that we defer to credibility findings that the district court made when presented with information that shows two different things: cooperation at some points, not cooperation at other points?
Standing back and again looking at this from 10,000 feet, what the evidence and what the record reflects is that the by far greater weight of the evidence suggests that my clients have a unique ability to cooperate with one another. And they don't just do it before court begins and there's litigation. They cooperate in the midst of litigation. I'm suggesting that there is a definitive mistake that's been made in asserting, the district court asserting, that it has concerns about their ability to cooperate. I can't see anything in the record that the court specifically relied upon that would tend to suggest that they do not have the ability to cooperate. In fact, the evidence is completely contrary. And it's for that reason that I'm invoking that firm conviction that a mistake has been made analysis. The same is true
on that point, the cooperation, Does the record support that father initially sought a dismissal of grandmother's petition and supported the child being adopted by grandfather? Then, less than a year later, after mother died, grandmother reported father to Child Protection Services, alleging the child was harmed while in father's care. In addition, it indicates the father has had limited contact with the child. All of that suggests they don't. So why, that seems like enough in the record to support that factor.
I think with due respect to the district court, if I've got 100 chips on the table, one or two might support the idea that they have not had a cooperative engagement in the past involving the CPS. That's really the one chip. The others, and I don't believe the record supports the idea, and I know you've asked about this before, Judge Connolly, the record does not support the notion that father has had absolutely no involvement. Father has had involvement. He has had routine weekend time with my client at her home. I see my time is up. May I finish the answer to the question?
Certainly.
All right. He has had time with grandmother at her home during the pendency of these proceedings. In the years leading up to this litigation, he and my client worked together to raise this child. The record is abundantly clear about the efforts they made to see that this minor child was adequately cared for. That's all I have at the present time. I'll await rebuttal.
Thank you. So we'll turn next to counsel for respondent. Again, feel free to adjust the podium and please introduce yourself, identify your client, and there are 15 minutes on the clock, so you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Skylar Troy, and I'm here representing the respondent in this matter, Mr. Bradley Slater. As with all child custody disputes, this case is ultimately about the best interest of the child that's at the center of the dispute. The proceedings at the district court, as opposing counsel pointed out, took roughly 16 months, about a year and a half, between the time that Ms. Raby filed her initial petition and when the district court issued its decision. And during that time, I would agree that a very extensive factual record was developed. District court very carefully considered the record. It properly applied the pertinent statutes under Chapter 257C of the Minnesota Code, and it correctly determined that awarding sole legal and physical custody to the child in this case was the respondent was in the child's best interests. The district court, despite statements to the contrary by opposing counsel, had intimate familiarity with the facts and the parties. I don't believe that it's fair to say that the district court at any point lost sight of those facts. And the district court's order reflects that very careful and thorough consideration of the record in its factual findings. And in seeking to reverse the district court's decision, the appellant's arguments largely hinge, as you all have pointed out, on their attempts to undermine the district court's factual findings, its credibility determinations, its balancing of the best interest factors. But under the applicable standard of review here, the abuse of discretion standard, appellate courts, in this court's own words, have very little room to disturb a district court's factual findings and balancing of the best interest factors unless there's a showing of clear error. And the appellants in this case simply have not met that burden. The appellants also invite this court to disregard the plain text of the applicable statutes. They do not cite to any authority that supports their positions or their constructions of the statutes at issue here. And they also offer some arguments essentially challenging the constitutionality of the application of those statutes.
Do you agree with your counterpart's argument about the joint custody factors under 257C.04 subdivision 2 that the district court needed to consider grandfather as a party in going through those factors?
I would make two different points there. The first is that it did, as you pointed out, in at least one of those factors, and it made broad statements about the kind of dynamics between all of the parties in particular throughout its findings of fact. That would be relevant to at least that portion of the statute. But the second, and I think more important point, is it would be illogical to try to apply this to the grandfather. The first factor under subdivision 2 of that statute is the ability of the parties to cooperate in the rearing of the child. In a scenario under the construction that the appellants are advancing here, it is unclear to me precisely how the district court is supposed to analyze the ability of a party who's not seeking joint custody to cooperate in the raising of a child with the other two parties who are seeking joint custody. The point is for the people seeking joint custody to prove out these factors, their ability to cooperate with each other, their methods for resolving disputes.
I understand that, but I mean, the language of the statute doesn't say the parties seeking joint custody. I suppose that's probably inherent in the title of the subdivision, but he was a party. The grandfather, your client, was a party because he intervened as an interested third party. So I don't know. I guess I'm wondering how you can address the best interest of the child, if that's the paramount concern of all these proceedings as you started your argument with, without considering all of the parties to the suit that are involved in rearing the child.
Well, I believe that it did. And I think perhaps the more important point here is that because the respondent was not seeking joint custody, it's unclear why it would have been his burden to advance evidence under any of those factors. That was not his affirmative claim. It would have been the burden of the, in that case, the plaintiffs at the district court to advance to provide evidence in support of their award that they were seeking of joint custody. The respondent never actually sought joint custody, so it's not clear why he would have needed to submit evidence. And if it was not his burden to submit evidence, then what would there have been for the district court to consider?
And the district court didn't specifically say in that finding that it was not considering grandfather, or just didn't mention grandfather in that finding.
That is correct. And it didn't even explicitly say that it was not considering grandfather, right, as you said. And I think, in fact, if I may check just briefly, I believe the court actually did address grandfather in at least one of those factors. That's kind of beside the point. As you all are very familiar with the abuse of discretion standard, in the particular context of child custody determinations, the court will view the record in the light that is most favorable to the district court's findings. And appellants that are challenging a child custody determination have to show that the district court made factual findings that were unsupported by the evidence or that they misapplied the law. And the appellants have not established that either actually occurred here. They make sweeping arguments that the court erred in making its custody determination, and they do this by attacking separate findings of fact and focusing on small and relatively narrow portions of the record that might support their theory of the case or that might contradict one of the findings that the district court actually included in its order. The respondent contends that that approach is limiting. It ignores substantial portions of the record that clearly support the district court's findings. And I would submit that a review of the entire record shows that each and every finding of fact in that order was supported by substantial evidence. It was an extensive record, as I've mentioned before. It culminated in a two-day trial. It lasted roughly 6 months from conception to the order being issued. And there were multiple motions along the way for temporary custody orders and responses to those motions and other filings. Hundreds of pages of exhibits included in this record as well. And the respondent provided extensive evidence that supported the district court's decision to award him sole legal and physical custody. And that included trial testimony from independent third-party witnesses. For example, at the time, the child's daycare provider, Ms. Wendy DeWall, testified very credibly throughout her testimony, and the district court highlighted many portions of her testimony. And you can see that it considered her testimony very carefully in the way that it crafted the order, because many of the things that were included as it pertains specifically to Ms. Raby's visitation rights were pulled directly from Ms. DeWall's testimony, like the thing about having his support items with him for the lovey, I think is what the daycare provider referred to it as. I won't go into all of the facts. You all have read the briefs, and it's all there, but at bottom, as it pertains to the factual disputes that the appellants have raised, all of these issues can be resolved by just a simple application of the standard of review here. There's substantial evidence in the record to support each and every finding of fact that the trial court made, And the appellant's arguments in essence are that the court could have reached a different conclusion if it had weighed the evidence differently. That doesn't satisfy the burden here. The burden here was to show that the findings were unsupported, and they have not done so. Turning kind of more towards the statutory construction issues that appellants have raised, and that would include this joint custody issue. They also contended in the briefing the court misapplied the law regarding the seventh best interest factor, and that is the one that requires the court to consider the length of time the child's been in a stable and satisfactory environment and the desirability of maintaining the continuity of that environment. The appellants argue that the court erred because it considered the time that this case was pending at the trial court in its findings of fact, and then when it held that factor to be in favor of the respondent. And they make this argument by lifting language from a different statute altogether, section 250C.01, subdivision 2B, and that lays out the test for a de facto custodian, determining a de facto custodian. And in that statute, it does say that the time that a matter is pending in the court should not be considered as part of the analysis as to whether a third party is, in fact, a child's de facto custodian. That language is not in 257C04 subdivision 4 anywhere. The language does not appear there. The appellants have not argued that the language is ambiguous. They've not cited to any authority that suggests their construction of the statute is the correct construction of the statute. And this court and the state of Minnesota in general has long held that when we're dealing with issues of statutory construction, if the statute is not ambiguous, courts must apply the plain meaning of the text as it's written and should not read requirements into the statute that do not exist in the text, and should not consider even the spirit or the purpose of the law. If the law is clear as it's written, then the courts should apply the law as it's written. And that is what the court here did. It applied the law as it was written. It properly declined to read this requirement into 257C.04 subdivision 4. Subdivision 1. So there was no error here by the district court.
Even if we were to agree that there was error, would finding that there was error on one of the factors be sufficient to reverse in this case?
No, and in fact, that's also in this statute as well. Subdivision 1B says explicitly the court may not use one factor to the exclusion of all others. And I don't believe that there's a reasonable argument that that has occurred here as well. The court was very thorough. It addressed each and every relevant factor under both the best interests test and the joint custody test, the de facto custodian test as it applied to the respondent, the interested third party test as it applied to Ms. Raby.
Can I ask you a question while we're talking about 1B? I realize I misspoke during your counterpart's argument. It's not case law that requires the detailed findings. It's for the best interest. For the custody factors under subdivision 1, it's subdivision 1B, the second sentence of it. And then
Yes. There's
a companion piece to that under subdivision 2, 2B. But that only applies, and this is, I'm jumping you back to my questions about joint custody to address their legal argument. The detailed findings, as I read this, only apply if the court awards joint legal or physical custody. And the court didn't award joint legal or physical custody. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, that's clearly what it says. I have it right here in front of me. It's subdivision 2-1, subdivision 2B, if I may just read it. It says if the court awards joint legal or physical custody over the objection of a party, the court must make detailed findings on each of the factors. The court did not award.
In your view, was the court even required to make any findings? As long as the court considered the joint custody, as there's evidence in the record, the court considered the joint custody factors, was the court required to make any findings at all, given that the court didn't award anyone joint?
If we're strictly talking about the way that the statute is written, and again, I would contend it's not particularly ambiguous or unclear, then I would say no, it was not required to make detailed findings. It certainly wouldn't have hurt. Right, but it's not like there was a requirement here that the court missed. Excuse me. And then finally, one of the key issues that was raised in appellant's opening brief was whether or not the district court erred because it failed to consider the father's fundamental rights as the child's natural parent when it awarded sole legal and physical custody to the respondent. Arguably, as we pointed out in our brief, we actually contend that this may not have been preserved for review because it was not raised explicitly at trial until after trial had occurred and post-trial letter briefs. Those briefs were submitted to the court simultaneously. The respondent never had an opportunity to respond directly to that particular argument. But even assuming that the issue was properly preserved for review, the appellant's argument is still unavailing here. The trial court was not required to explicitly discuss the constitutional principles of the fundamental rights of parents to the care, custody, and control of their children. And this court has articulated that pretty directly in the past, fairly recently, in fact. In the case of in re custody of ALR, it was decided by this court in 2013. And in that case, the court held that the common law presumption in favor of parental custody is incorporated in Chapter 257C of the Minnesota Code, and that by virtue of the court engaging in a proper analysis of the facts as it pertains to those statutes, if the court does not make an error in applying the law, then it is implied or is implicit that it has addressed those constitutional issues. Just because the court did not specifically discuss the fundamental rights, quote unquote, of the father in this case does not mean that was not part of the calculation. And the statutes, as they're written and as they're applied by the court, contemplate that part of the analysis by creating these factors under the best interest test and the de facto custodian test and the interested third party test to probe at the various weaknesses in someone's argument regarding the presumption in favor of parental custody. It's been laid out for decades, maybe perhaps longer, how, see, my time is up, if I may just finish this answer. It has long been held in the state of Minnesota and the United States more broadly that parents do have a fundamental right. That right is not absolute, and the Supreme Court itself has said that. So that argument is not particularly convincing as well.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right, and we'll turn back to counsel for appellant for rebuttal. We'll have 5 minutes on the clock. Feel free to begin when you're ready.
Thank you. And again, Jason Brown for the appellants. I'd like to just direct the court to the record with regard to an issue that has been raised as of concern, specifically what father's role has been in the life of this child. And I think this is most notable. Grandfather's own testimony at trial was that following mother's death, father and grandmother were more involved than he was in caring for the minor child. That's his own testimony. Second day of trial testimony, transcript page 25. Similarly, grandfather at page 87 of the second day trial transcript acknowledged there was a time father served as Chiari's primary caregiver following mother's passing. The record also reflects, Your Honors, that Mr. Coffey Ingesson is a member of the United States military, and much of the time that he was away from this child is attributed directly to service to this country. And during that time away, he continued to remain in contact to the best of his ability with both mother and grandmother. As important, within the record, there was testimony that reflects that during the course of this litigation, following the time that grandfather denied father access to his own son, grandmother allowed father to spend time with Chiari every other weekend when he was in grandmother's care, holidays and birthdays. And that's reflected on day one trial testimony, pages 171 to 172.
Do you take issue with the finding that grandfather was a de facto custodian then?
I don't take issue with the fact that he is by statute defined as a de facto custodian. What I take issue with, and I think what's gotten lost in all of this, is how he became a de facto custodian. He did it under false pretenses, and we've outlined what all of those pressure tactics and false statements were to father that motivated father to have the minor child remain in his care. A few other points that counsel raised with regard to the raising of the 16 months it took to get this case to trial. Our argument is not that, you know, the court needs to take that into account and rather can't use that in its analysis. That's just kind of a general statement of the sentiment of myself after years of handling custody and parenting time disputes. It seems litigants, depending on their point of view, have a certain advantage the longer a case goes on because a child remains in that litigant's care. And I just think from a policy perspective, we're not here to reinvent everything. It would be really nice if cases like this could move along a much faster track than this case did. With regard to whether this court needs to find merely one factor misapplied in order to reverse and remand, the answer is absolutely yes. One factor is sufficient. There is, albeit an unreported case, the Dittbrenner case, 2007 Westlaw, 1248047. And in that case, the sole issue that justified reversal was the health and welfare of a parent, their emotional capacity to care for a child. That one factor led this court to reverse and remand back to the district court.
You're not challenging. I mean, that's not relevant in this case, right?
That is not relevant, but the case stands for the proposition, and I think that it clearly outlines the fact that there was one best interest factor that it found there was an abuse of the court's discretion in that case, and as a result, the court reversed and remanded.
Well, yes. I mean, if the person is mentally unstable, And based on that mental instability, cannot care for the child, obviously that is going to trump everything. That's not this case, right?
That's not this case, but the law doesn't say...
So, I mean, I'm not so sure. That one factor, I would agree with you. But for common sense reasons, I mean, we're not going to give someone custody if they're mentally unbalanced, but that is far removed from this case, in my opinion, speaking only for myself.
It is, Your Honor. I see my time is up. If I may just briefly comment.
Yes.
My brief comment would be this, that no one factor, as counsel alluded to, no one factor is to trump all other factors when it comes to an award of custody and parenting time. The fact that in one circumstance someone has an alcohol problem or is in another circumstance an emotionally challenging position, that's different case to case. I'm not suggesting that's a mirror reflection of this case. What I am suggesting is that from a broader point of view, if this court finds that the court abused its discretion with regard to just one of these, I suppose, 16 different factors, the court has the inherent authority to reverse and remand. And we do request that the court do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your argument here today, as well as the briefs. This case is submitted, and an opinion will be issued in the statutory time frame. Thank you.